A New Mexico federal judge stops a jail from holding inmates so federal agents can determine a prisoner's immigration status. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. This month, the Trump administration started publishing a weekly report of local and state law enforcement agencies that refuse to detain people while Immigration and Customs Enforcement determines their legal status. But a New Mexico federal judge recently approved a settlement that prohibits the San Juan County Jail from doing just that, holding inmates past their release date when ICE agents request it. The ruling stems from a lawsuit filed by Somos Un Pueblo Unido, a Santa Fe-based immigrant advocacy group. KUNM's Chris Burrows spoke with Somos Communications Director Nessa Leal about the case.
So what happened? Who took who to court and why?
This lawsuit was originally filed in 2014 by immigrant families in San Juan County who were having their civil rights violated by the jail by being held beyond the time that was authorized by a judge solely based on an immigration detainer or a request by ICE to investigate their immigration status.
So what does this mean for the San Juan County Jail and how they treat people who are being held there?
Well, first, it's unfortunate that the federal government continues to intimidate local jails and local governments into violating the civil rights of the residents. These requests by ICE or immigration officials to local jails are not legally bound, meaning that local jails do not have to honor them whatsoever.
Now, Governor Susana Martinez, though, ordered state prison officials to cooperate with federal immigration agents. And 2 weeks ago, after a request from ICE, the State Corrections Department presented a list of foreign-born prisoners. Does this court ruling affect what the state can do?
The governor has been instructing the Corrections Department to do this for many, many years. So the practice here is not new. The announcement is new. And what's happening across the country and here in New Mexico is that, you know, local jails and communities are sort of proactively passing policies that prevent this sort of thing from happening.
The Obama administration focused on deporting people who had been convicted of crimes, and President Trump has broadened that. Isn't it a good idea to deport dangerous convicted criminals?
Well, the thing with these requests is that it was individuals who were arrested for, you know, a traffic ticket. And so what we want to be able to separate is that local jails are not obligated by any means to honor these requests by ICE beyond what a judge orders. And so we can separate what is civil immigration law and criminal justice.
That was KUNM's Chris Burrows speaking with Nessa Leal of Somos Un Pueblo Unido, an immigrant advocacy group in Santa Fe. There's a new form of cooperation happening on the California-Mexico border. The San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce signed a historic memorandum of understanding with Mexico Senate on Tuesday. The agreement expands the influence of San Diego and Northern Baja California leaders, giving them say on Mexican legislation related to ports of entry, trade, and immigration. It also establishes a working group made up of business leaders and politicians from the San Diego-Tijuana region, as well as members of the Mexican Senate. Jean Guerrero of KPBS has details from Mexico City.
The Mexican Senate erupted in applause as the Memorandum of Understanding was signed. It creates mechanisms for San Diego and Northern Baja California leaders to collaborate on federal legislation in Mexico. Senate representatives will meet with border region leaders twice a year to discuss immigration, trade, and border infrastructure. One of those annual meetings will take place in San Diego or Tijuana rather than Mexico City. Chamber President Jerry Sanders addressed a crowd of Mexican reporters outside of the Senate.
Our goal is that this agreement serves as a model that others can use to establish their own agreements with Senate representatives.
The reporters were eager to hear about this agreement, which brings the U.S. and Mexico closer together. It stands in stark contrast to headlines about President Trump's proposed border wall, which some fear pushes the countries farther apart. The chamber's in Mexico City this week, leading an annual delegation of nearly 90 business leaders and politicians from the San Diego-Tijuana region. Late last night, they met with Mexico's Foreign Relations Minister, Luis Videgaray. Paola Avila of the chamber said the meeting was fruitful.
We wanted to make sure that he knew that we were a partner, that while there is a very negative message that has been received in Mexico, that is not shared by everyone.
Videgaray promised to secure federal Mexican funds for the construction of Otay 2, a toll-operated port of entry planned for Otay Mesa. He also committed to help a binational railroad move forward through Tecate.
That was Jean Guerrero of KPBS reporting from Mexico City. Now to that controversial classroom used as a prayer room at a suburban Dallas high school. We told you last week that Attorney General Ken Paxton's office sent a letter raising constitutional concerns about the room. The Frisco Independent School District superintendent called the letter a publicity stunt and says the prayer room has been in use for several years without complaints. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, prayer rooms are just one way public schools in Frisco and across Texas accommodate students and religion.
Tim Boyer was so unhappy about the prayer room at Liberty High that he went to this week's Frisco School Board meeting to speak his mind.
Liberty High School is not a mosque. It's not a synagogue. It's not a tabernacle. It's not a temple. It's not a church. It is a school.
The Frisco School District says it hasn't violated any state or federal laws by having a prayer room, and that the room is open to students of all faiths. It's not clear how many public schools in Texas have prayer rooms or designated areas where students can pray, but they are in some schools across the state and country.
You may hear it said sometimes that prayer's been kicked out of public schools, but in fact, what has been determined by the courts is that schools can't compel prayer.
That's Joy Baskin. She's the director of legal services with the Texas Association of School Boards. She says prayer rooms are acceptable. That's because, legally, schools can give students time to pray, whether it's during free time or a lunch period. They can give students passes to leave class to pray or leave campus for religious education.
It's a concept that courts have looked at for many years. It's called release time, and it's the idea that in order to follow a tenet of faith, the student is briefly excused.
Time for prayer isn't the only religious accommodation you'll find in public schools. Students can wear a head covering, for example, or schools can meet students' dietary restrictions due to their religion. Baskin says all of this is okay as long as it's not an undue burden on the school.
There are students in Texas who have asked to be excused all day on Fridays, every Friday, in order to attend religious services on Friday. And most districts have considered that an undue burden because of the amount of class that the students would miss.
Liberty High established a prayer room in part because Muslim students were leaving school on Fridays to pray, and they were gone for about 2 hours. Kelly Shackelford is president and CEO of First Liberty Institute in Plano. It's a legal organization that focuses on religious freedom. He says the Texas Attorney General's office raises valid concerns, but what he's heard so far from the Frisco School District also falls in line with what his group supports.
It's fine to have an accommodation, a place for students where they can pray, as long as they're neutral, as long as they provide the same accommodations for other students, other faiths.
Shackelford says the more common legal battles involving schools and religion are when a school is trying to shut down religious expression. He says some schools fear that they're going to get in trouble if religion or religious expression happens in the school.
The law is that we don't want the government, you know, which is running the schools, to push religion or try to force anybody into a particular religion, but to provide the students who have perfect freedom under the First Amendment to live out their faith.
The Islamic Center of Frisco has released a statement in support of the school district's efforts. The group says it was astonished the letter from the Attorney General's office came a day after the district's interfaith breakfast with religious leaders. Saba Ilyas is a board member of the Islamic Center. She says people have been stopping by the Frisco Mosque daily to ask questions about Islam.
I have seen the dynamic of Frisco change. We used to be the only minority in our elementary school, 10 years ago, and now that's not the case. So the dynamic is definitely changing, and what I'm seeing more are people who want to know, and they're reaching out.
Ilyas says that face-to-face interaction is a better way to build understanding rather than sending a letter. For Fronteras, I'm Stella Chavez.
In response to the prayer room controversy stirred by Attorney General Ken Paxton's letter, his office recently issued a statement saying he'd been in contact with the district's lawyers, who assured him that students of all faith or no faith can use the meeting room during non-instructional time for student-led activities. Paxton added, quote, "Religious liberty is a cornerstone of our society, and we are glad that students at Frisco ISD may practice their faith in accordance with their beliefs." Coming up on Fronteras, four San Antonio College students crossed the Gulf of Mexico to Cuba, thanks to their forward-thinking teacher.
He just sat back and he was like, Obama just dropped the embargo on Cuba. We should go to Cuba. And he kind of just came up with the idea right there in front of us.
We'll explore that story and the far-reaching legacy of a Texas singer who died young when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Four guitarists studying at the University of Texas at San Antonio recently took their instruments to Cuba to make beautiful music and represent the Alamo City. They played four concerts for Cuban locals during their week there. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan caught up with them before their culturally immersive trip.
I'm Ashley Lucero.
My name is Dan Schumacher.
My name is Abram Fernandez.
My name is Aiden Witten.
And what the UTSA Guitar Quartet does is this.
It's quite complicated to tour professionally in Cuba.
Matthew Dunn runs the program at UTSA. Dunn and the four musicians flew to Cuba. Coordinating performance venues, transportation, and lodging is no small task. Ponytailed, minstrel-looking Aiden Witten says the trip all seemed to happen rather suddenly last summer.
I was in his office, I think with Dan, maybe Ashley too, and he just sat back and he was like, Obama just dropped the embargo on Cuba. We should go to Cuba. And he kind of just came up with the idea right there in front of us.
In fact, the trip was something Dunn had been looking into for months. It was the four students' determination that inspired the idea in the first place.
These students are particularly dedicated and particularly fine players, and I wanted to arrange a concert tour for them in another country.
We really need to work on the 6-8 sections. They need to be lighter.
As the only postgraduate in the quartet, Ashley Lucero is the senior member. She says the best-case scenario for performances is when she gets to a psychological state she calls the flow.
You're not thinking anymore. It's automatic. And that's when you achieve this flow that allows you to actually execute these things with such great accuracy.
Lucero says that through practice and spending so many hours together, much of the communication in the quartet happens without a word.
When I feel like I'm getting really intense with the music and I sort of turn on this switch that I can tell the other guys in the quartet can pick up on it, and I can tell they start kind of revving up in intensity, and when that happens, it's the best.
Dan Schumacher says they're also studying in a master class with Cuban guitar master Leo Brower, where he will critique and give them guitar guidance. One point of stress? They're actually playing a composition Brower himself wrote.
Yeah, we're playing Leo Brower's Cuban Landscape with Rain.
In Cuba.
In Cuba. And we're going to get to play it for Leo Brower. I love Leo Brower. I've learned probably 12 to 20 of his pieces over the last 4 years.
One part of that composition sounds chaotic for a good reason.
There's one part where we do something called Bartok picks, which is where we grab the string with both fingers and pull it up and then let it go. And so it bounces against the fretboard.
It's almost like rain falling or something, right?
Right, that's the point, right? That's what he's going for.
Aidan Whitten teaches guitar now and eventually wants to do so at the college level. He tells the Teach a Man to Fish story and likens its lesson to teaching guitar.
When you play a performance for people, that's kind of like you giving them the fish and you're feeding them for that day. And that's very satisfying. But, you know, there's something even greater about teaching. You're really sharing an art form, and then you're getting close personal relationships with students, and watching them grow is just a beautiful thing.
Another song they're playing for the Cuban Guitar Master is one written by Dan Schumacher.
I'm really excited to play my piece that I wrote. Aidan and I are playing a piece, a ragtime called Cigarette Memoir, and I think it's a really exciting opportunity because ragtime is this American music that has influences from, you know, Africa and from all these different sources, and so it'll be cool to play that in a different country and see how they respond to it.
Dunn thinks the trip is one that'll stay with his students for the rest of their lives.
I think that this could be a life-changing event for these students. They're going to meet their peers from a very, very different culture. They don't speak the same language, but I think they'll find a great deal of common ground in their love and dedication to the guitar.
The group will leave more than memories of great music behind. They're taking 100 sets of donated strings and guitar accessories to Cuban guitarists who have a hard time getting new strings. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
We end our show remembering a young Texas icon, Selena Quintanilla. Thousands of Selena fans celebrated her life and legacy this past weekend in Corpus Christi at Fiesta de la Flor. The beloved singer was killed 22 years ago this month. She was only 23. In the year since her death, Selena has been embraced by the LGBTQ community and by one transgender woman in particular. The Texas Standard's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. has the story.
Selena! You're still not driving!
In the YouTube video I'm watching, the auditorium is pitch black. Dialogue from the 1997 Selena movie plays in the darkness. Suddenly, a bright white spotlight hits center stage, revealing Honey Andrews. Selena's 1992 hit Como La Flor floods the venue and Andrews starts dancing. The crowd erupts into applause and cheers as Honey Andrews shows off her black leather pants and a bedazzled red bra. Media outlets like Fusion and Cosmopolitan have argued Andrews is one of the country's best Selena impersonators. Andrews performs iconic Selena choreography and lip syncs without missing a beat. 31-year-old Andrews has been doing this for years. Before it was in front of an audience, it was in front of her mirror at home. As a little boy, he spent hours dancing to Selena songs, pretending to be the singer. Selena became one of Honey Andrews' biggest idols. In fact, Selena was in part the woman Andrews wanted to be.
She was just an amazing, amazing woman all around. She had, you know, everything that not many celebrities have. She had the whole package. She had talent. She had beauty. She had poise. She was always such a down-to-earth person.
But Selena wasn't just someone Andrews looked up to. Andrews says the singer helped her find her identity as a trans woman. The transition was still confusing for her family.
It's very hard for any Mexican family to accept having a different family member. It's a very hard subject to bring up on a Mexican family, you know, having the little boy slowly blossoming into a woman.
Andrews and many others of the LGBTQ communities now hail Selena's legacy. Deborah Paredes is a professor at Columbia University and the author of Selenidad, Selena, Latinos, and the Performance of Memory. Paredes says Selena gave the LGBTQ community a new kind of icon, someone who thrived outside of the traditionally celebrated European ideal of beauty.
So suddenly Selena became a figure who, you know, brown folks could perform and assert, you know, both a cultural pride in reimagining what glamour might look like.
Andrew says she only performs as Selena, and it's never been her intention to be Selena 100% of the day. But she does say they actually have some similarities.
We're both Latinas, dark skin, long hair, long black hair, you know, full lips.
And unlike rock and roll, Selena did not create a chasm between the generations. She was someone grandmothers and grandchildren listened to.
For many queer communities whose families of origin had shunned them or who had been exiled from their families of origin because of families not accepting who they were, because of Selena's cross-generational appeal, Selena providing a way for queer folks to kind of come home, right? Provided this avenue, this point of connection between themselves and their families of origin, that even if they couldn't literally go back home to those families, it provided for them, again, a kind of representational space or a sonic space or a space of desire where a kind of cultural identification and or a familial one and a sexual identification could kind of come together in a moment of resolution.
That's one connection Honey Andrews and her parents could always count on. Selena is far from an icon of the past. Her music is now attracting the younger generation. At this weekend's concerts for Fiesta de la Flor, you could see toddlers wearing glitzy Selena caps and older children singing along. They, too, were falling in love with Selena decades after her death. I'm Reynaldo Llanos Jr. for the Texas Standard.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.